Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. The greater sage grouse is an icon of the West. It is a large, rounded-winged, spike-tailed, ground-dwelling bird, about 2 feet tall and weighing from 2 to 7 pounds. Females are a mottled brown, black, and white. Males are larger and have a large white ruff around their neck and bright yellow air sacs on their chest, which they inflate during their elaborate mating displays, carried out in breeding areas known as leks. The birds are found at elevations ranging to 9,000 feet and are highly dependent on sagebrush for cover and feed. Once seen in great numbers across western landscapes, sage grouse have declined in number over the past 100 years because of the loss, degradation, and fragmentation of their essential sagebrush habitats. They now occupy only about 56% of the habitat that was available to them before the arrival of European settlers. They now occupy only about 56% of the habitat that was available to them before the arrival of European settlers. Allie Jones is trying to improve that percentage. She is the conservation biologist for Wild Utah Project.
And the mission of Wild Utah Project is to maintain productivity in our wild places within Utah and adjacent states. So maintain and conserve the natural productivity of our wildlands. And we do this in many ways, but one fundamental way we do it is to bring conservation science into the business of public land management. And there's a lot of ways you can bring science into land management. Mm-hmm. Comment periods, collaborative relationships with agencies and other stakeholders, figuring out what's the best direction to go for land management in certain areas of the state and beyond. We also work in adjacent states.
And what do you mean by natural productivity?
So productivity, we basically refer to the natural functioning state of ecosystems and their ability to provide all their natural services for both the human and wildlife community. Things ranging from forage, cover, protection, ecosystem services, nutrient cycling, everything. It's all wrapped up into productivity, if you will, of rangelands, deserts, all of our native ecosystems.
And then how do you determine what land or what species to work with?
Well, there's a few ways that Wild Utah Project gets involved in different areas or issues. One is that we write grants to tackle certain big problems, often working with coalitions. For example, we're very active with the Three Forests Coalition, which is focused on land management issues on the southern Utah, Manti-La Salle, Fish Lake, and Dixie National Forests, issues ranging from oil and gas development to timber harvest to ORV management, and of course, you guessed it, livestock grazing is a big focus of a lot of the work that we focus on Wild Utah Project. And the other way we get involved with certain projects or issues or problems are when our conservation partners come to us, because we function as sort of an affordable consulting arm to all of Utah's nonprofit conservation groups who don't have their own scientists on staff or their own GIS mapping abilities. So we provide the scientific and technical and mapping support to, you can pretty much name the nonprofit environmental group in Utah, and we provide these services to them. So we get drawn into a lot of the issues and projects of our partner groups because they need our help. And that's sort of where this involvement with sage grouse came along.
Okay. There
weren't too many conservation groups really focused on this species, but yet big things are happening on the conservation front, policy front, Endangered Species Act front. all land management, land uses, all revolving around this bird. And so we've kind of jumped into the fray.
The Gunnison Sage Grouse Range covers 13 states and into Canada. Their current total population is estimated at 200,000 birds.
Which sounds like a lot until you compare it to the millions and millions that were there, you know, pre-settlement. And, you know, Utah is kind of a typical snapshot of what's happened with the species over time. Our numbers have declined by about 50% from what we think was here historically. So we're currently down to best estimates somewhere between 15 and 20,000 individuals. And this is, you know, partly the result of what's been estimated to be a 40% loss of habitat across the state of Utah since, you know, pre-settlement times, basically.
Do you know why the Gunnison levels in our numbers would be so low compared to the greater sage grouse?
Well, because they occupy a tiny, tiny fragment of the landscape. They're subspecies found only in that part of, you know, extreme southeast Utah and southwest Colorado. So because of isolation from the rest of the greater sage grouse, to which they're closely related, probably the Colorado River has something to do with that isolation, and the mountain ranges, the Rocky Mountains, you know, to the east. It's just a small pocket that evolved on their own path, enough to be their own subspecies. So, I mean, they only occur over how many, you know, square miles compared to the entire western U.S. That's why its population's smaller.
I understand the oil and gas. I can see how that would be a problem, right? That the disturbance of the area, mm-hmm, for and their breeding grounds. Do you know what those issues are? I would imagine sound, noise, and just disturbance of their nesting sites.
Right. You pretty much hit it on the head. So sage grouse can be disturbed directly, you know, by their habitat being plowed under for coal bed methane or coal strip mining or something like that. Then they can be disturbed more indirectly. And there's a lot of ways this can happen. One is unusual noise from compressors or oil rigs or what have you. Roads, they're not fond of roads. There's been many studies that look at all sorts of variables and indicators of disturbance, such as number of males who show up on leks, number of females who show up on leks, number of successful nests, number of successful chicks raised. And those numbers will go down the closer you get to a road, or the more use is on the road, or the closer you get to the oil and gas drill rig. And these effects can radiate out, depending on the study, miles, usually at least 2 or 3 miles. And this goes for the noise impacts, the human impacts. And then there's the tall structure problem. With these power lines, power poles, transmission lines, drill rigs, the tall structures offer new and more perching habitat for predators such as hawks and eagles. And so sage grouse don't like tall structures. Even fences offer just that additional, you know, bit of perching habitat for the predators. So we know that sage grouse don't like and avoid these tall structures.
Are there any regulations that these companies have to follow? Do they have to try and avoid the sage grouse?
Right. There are, and they're evolving. And in the old days, someone came up with this figure, 0.25 miles, that they figured would be a suitable buffer around the leks, which is the, you know, the breeding and strutting ground, that would be a good enough buffer to keep the oil and gas development outside of that area, and the lek would be fine. Studies show that that buffer is not good enough. Currently in Wyoming, the standard buffer is 1 mile, what they call no surface occupancy, a 1 mile radius around that lek. Other states are adopting that. A lot of the oil and gas companies in northeast Utah have been using it right now, a 1/2 mile buffer. This might all change. One of the reasons we're meeting is the state's coming up with new sage-grouse recommendations to try to avoid the federal listing under the Endangered Species Act. We're assuming, you know, 0.5 miles will be figured out to not be good enough. So we're waiting to see what it ends up being. Literature, and there's a lot of it, certainly shows that in most cases, actually a mile buffer is not good enough. But the industry seems to be falling back on it anyway. We'll just have to see how the bird does in these areas.
And so what will it mean if the bird is listed as a federally endangered species? What will it mean to these companies, or what will it mean for your organization and for the stakeholders?
We don't know yet. A lot needs to still play out before we get the final decision from Fish and Wildlife Service about whether they'll list the sage-grouse as endangered or threatened, another option, which is one notch, you know, below mm-hmm. endangered, not as bad in the eyes of the oil and gas companies. And if that happens, then the Fish and Wildlife Service gets to call the shots in terms of these buffers around LECs and how much disturbance would be allowed in occupied habitat and that sort of thing. If they, you know, go strictly off the scientific literature, those buffers will probably have to be more than a mile. Does that mean they'd be two or four? A lot of studies show 4 miles is how far away major disturbance needs to be for a LEC to be successful and promote the viability of the population. So that is a very good question that I certainly cannot answer.
And I should know this answer, but what are the criteria for a species to be listed as threatened or endangered? Is there a certain population size?
You know, that's tricky. The service has to be able to, through, you know, the numbers, know or demonstrate that the bird or the species is in danger of going extinct within a significant portion of its range. And so species that make it onto the endangered species list are really in peril. They're only, you know, down to 10% of what their historic numbers were, for example. And trends are down. They're not up. Things like that. So you can kind of, there's no golden rule, like once you only have 1,000 animals, obviously it can't be because it's so different for large-bodied species versus small-bodied species. So there's no golden rule, but when you compare current numbers to historical averages and when the trend has been down, in the case of the sage-grouse, for about 30 years, a pretty consistent downward trend, that catches the service's attention. And they've already said it's warranted. They've already said that sage-grouse is warranted for listing based on basically what I just told you. They are giving the states basically one more chance to improve their stewardship of this species. That's where we're at. The decision will be in 2015. Yeah, they're giving the states time to beef up those stewardship promises and make good on the promises the states have already made. You know, all the western states have made stewardship promises to sensibly manage their own wildlife within their borders. Unfortunately, as we've seen with many species, not just the sage-grouse, sometimes other factors, economic interests, politics, get in the way of meeting their stewardship promises for our wildlife. And, you know, an analogy is our health, human health. And if you imagine a world where preventive care is optional and you don't really choose to put your health as a top priority and take care of yourself, you might end up in the emergency room. And that's where we are at with the sage-grouse. It's in the intensive care unit. And so the ways that Utah and the other western states have been managing habitat for this species probably need to change, and it'll be for the good of all species in the sagebrush ecosystem and the livestock that graze there and the humans that, you know, live and use those watersheds. The sagebrush ecosystem has a canary in the coal mine. It's the sage-grouse. It's an indicator of healthy ecosystems. It's an indicator of how well these states have done meeting their stewardship promises.
Can you talk about how the collaborations are working now, who's working together, and what the meetings involve? And
so the state of Utah really scrambled earlier this year in the winter to put together became an 18-member working group with representatives from oil and gas industry, utilities, the tar sands and oil shale industry, power companies, ranchers, sportsmen, the federal land management agencies such as U.S. Forest Service. Obviously, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a seat at the table. They're a very important player. The State Division of Wildlife Resources, obviously, they're managing the species. And one environmental interest at the table, the Nature Conservancy, is the representative to the conservation community. So they put that group together, and they started meeting in rapid succession, in every other week, with the goal to come up with, they're not calling it a management plan. They're calling it a set of recommendations to the governor. The goal was to do this in 90 days. That turned into 120 days. No matter how you slice it, it's very fast. But their window is small because they're trying to feed their product into the Bureau of Land Management's planning process. They've got a big thing going on for sage-grouse. They're in the process of amending 68 land management plans across the West to incorporate better sage-grouse. Really, it comes down to habitat management into those resource plans. They're doing this because the Fish and Wildlife Service 2 years ago, in their warranted for listing decision, pointed the finger pretty squarely at the land management agencies and said there is a lack of adequate regulatory mechanisms in place in terms of managing this bird and especially its habitat and conserving its habitat in any way. And so, to make a long story short, the state of Utah is scrambling to get its product so it can be put in sort of an alternative into the Bureau of Land Management's land management plan revisions for the bird.
And do you know what some of those are, those scrambles are? What are they trying to hurry and fix?
They're trying to come up with a set of recommendations, including some specifics, like what would these lek buffer be around the leks. Other specifics, such as what would be the allowable percent of land that could be disturbed in occupied sage-grouse habitat. Wyoming currently has something like 86% of all their population centers included in what they call core areas. Within those core areas, they have very strict stipulations that no more than 5% of the land base can be disturbed with surface disturbance. So Utah is trying to kind of do what Wyoming already did. Wyoming's plan already got the seal of approval from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. For Utah's plan, their plan also needs to pass muster with the Fish and Wildlife Service. So Utah's got a tricky goal.
That was Allie Jones, conservation biologist for Wild Utah Project. For more information or to provide your own input on the issue, visit sierraclub.org. Sherry Quinn for Access Utah. Stay tuned for Science Questions coming up next. Such is the way of the world, you can never know just where to put all your faith and how will it grow. Gonna rise up.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about the Utah artist considered to be among the top women American artists, teacher, dancer, rancher, and tenacious painter, Minerva Tykert. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
Artist Minerva Kohlhepp Tykert was born in North Ogden, Utah in 1888. Throughout her life, she captured on canvas the great Mormon pioneer story and the story of the American West. Minerva grew up in a large family in a remote ranch in Idaho. Her mother was the daughter of one of Brigham Young's bodyguards, and her father had been disowned by his prominent family when he joined the LDS Church. The religious and pioneer stories told by her parents inspired Minerva's art all her life. Though women artists were not common in the West during this time, there is no doubt that the young Minerva got an early start to her career. When she was 4 years old, her mother gave her a set of watercolors, and from then on, Minerva considered herself an artist. She carried sketch pad and charcoal with her constantly, a practice she maintained into adulthood. As a young woman, Minerva taught school to save money to attend the Art Institute of Chicago and was the first woman to be sent for art lessons with the official blessing of the LDS Church. She later received a scholarship to study at the Art Students League in New York City, one of the most important art centers in the world. To pay her way, she sketched cadavers for medical schools, illustrated children's books, painted portraits, and performed rope tricks and Indian dances on the New York stage. Minerva turned down opportunities to further her career in the East and instead returned home to paint the history of the Mormon people. She married cowboy Herman Tykert and with him ran their ranch and raised their five children. Somehow, she also painted. Her studio was their living room, which was too small for her large works, so she folded her murals as she painted and, to get the correct perspective, viewed her canvases through the wrong end of a pair of binoculars. Her children were sent to bed at 8 o'clock each night so she could paint until midnight. Tykert produced prolifically, painting more pioneer and Indian subjects than any other Utah artist. Women and Western themes feature prominently in her work, and she is noted for a series of murals depicting the scenes from the Book of Mormon. Her aim was to produce works of art that would motivate people, in her words, to build Zion. She created more than 60 murals that adorn public places in Utah, and her work is in museum collections throughout the state. Minerva Tykert died in 1976 in Provo, Utah. Content for this episode of the Beehive Archive was provided by the Springville Museum of Art. Sources and past episode of the Beehive Archive may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Support for Science Questions comes from Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery.
Glaciers around the world are melting at an unprecedented rate, and glacier shrinkage is evidence of climate change across the globe. This is the sound of two enormous chunks of ice rubbing up against each other. Massive chunks of glacier ice, the size of living rooms, are crashing down and are affecting humans everywhere. Places like the Andes, the Himalayas, and the tallest African peak of Kilimanjaro.
Lonnie Thompson is a paleoclimatologist and distinguished professor at Ohio State University. He collects and studies ice. It's a race against time because, as Thompson puts it, glaciers are losing their memory. He has worked in over 15 countries on 5 continents and spends a good deal of time climbing glaciers with a large drill to extract cores of ice. He talks about his latest venture to a tropical glacier.
2 o'clock in the afternoon, there were thunderstorms, which is a big issue if you're drilling on the highest place with it's like having the world's highest lightning rod. But I really, it was the first time I had this sinking feeling that we were too late to actually get a history from, to recover that history, to salvage the history from a tropical glacier. And it still remains to be seen using today's techniques if we can actually pull that record together.
Thompson has achieved global recognition for his drilling and analysis of ice core samples from mountain glaciers and ice caps in the tropical and subtropical regions of the world. He now has 7,000 meters of ice core samples stored, helping to build an invaluable archive at Ohio State dating back 700,000 years.
This archive contains ice from glaciers that are already gone. Melting is two times as fast in the tropics due to higher levels of precipitation beating down on the snowpack. Each core sample, a rod about a foot in diameter and 10 meters long, is a unique window into human and environmental history.
Ice is, I believe, and maybe in part because I've studied it for so long, but I believe it's one of the best recorders we have of the past. Anything that's in the atmosphere falls out with the snow, and it can be studied. And anything from pollen in the tropics to insects. I mean, you wouldn't think on an ice field at 22,000 feet in the Andes that you would find insects, but they get carried up by storms and they're perfectly preserved in the ice.
It's not only plants and insects that are well preserved in the ice. Glaciers are such astute guardians of history that when a 5,300-year-old man known as Itzi was found in the ice, they could determine that he had an entree of red deer meat accompanied by a grain and a side of fruit 8 hours before he died, reportedly from an arrow in the back.
The idea of thousands of frozen artifacts stretches the imagination, as most of us don't think of our history unfolding in the strata of the world's ice.
But there's a history of temperature in the isotopes in the ice. There's a history of precipitation in the layer thicknesses. There's a history of volcanic eruptions. One of the studies we're looking at right now in South America is, when did metallurgy begin? It was in place before the Spanish arrived. So it was, but when was it developed? Well, in the heavy metals in the glaciers should be a record of when the first smelting started. So there are a lot of different issues you can tackle with that particular archive.
Outside of studying metallurgy, what are the other things you've discovered in the ice so far?
We work with anthropologists and archaeologists looking at the history of climate. There's always this issue of debate of, you know, what role did the environment play in the rise and fall of cultures in the past? And in the Andes, we can look at precipitation, temperature, long before the Spanish arrived. But when there were very well-developed cultures like the Mochi, the Tiwanaku, the Wari cultures, and look at what the climate was year by year on the rise and fall of those civilizations. And you know, what can you learn from looking at that relationship in the past to apply to cultures of today?
If we look at history of people in the Andes, they moved from the highlands to the coastal areas and back, mainly driven by moisture and water availability. And water level fluctuations are greatly affected by glacier runoff.
And glaciers are kind of nature's way of moderating water flow. It collects it in the wet season and snow, and then in the dry season they slowly melt and they keep a discharge.
Since the 1940s, migration patterns have not followed the natural water cycle. Modern irrigation technology has allowed people to move more freely from highlands to the coastal desert cities like Lima in hopes of a better way of life for their children, better schools, more job opportunities.
In today's world, two-thirds of the population of Peru live in the western coastal deserts and subsist on rivers that originate from glaciers up in the Andes. 76% of their power is hydropower generated from those rivers, but there is a threshold that will be passed when suddenly there'll be no more water flow in these rivers. In other words, this lifestyle can only last as long as the glaciers do.
But as the glaciers get smaller, there's less and less water in the dry season. There's less power on the grid. But what you see in the last 100 years, precipitation has been increasing in the highlands. In the natural scheme of things, of what happened in the past, people should be moving from the coast inland. But we now have, you know, the modern cultures, and we have government policies in Peru where they're developing the desert areas, turning them into crops. Peru is now the number one asparagus producer for the world. They ship green asparagus to New York and white asparagus to Europe. And you look at the economics of this. They're dependent on water coming from rivers, coming from glaciers in the Andes, coming out in the coastal desert to irrigate those fields, and then shipping them around the world. And you wonder, you know, just how does this work, and is this sustainable, you know, going forward? The history would say that, yeah, people should be actually leaving the coastal areas, going to the wetter highlands where water is more abundant. And so we're kind of countering what has been the natural cycle in that part of the world.
Although these Peruvian communities are not yet feeling the full impact of drought, they are already experiencing water shortages, and there's already a reduction in power on the grid in the dry season.
And the way the government is offsetting that is to build more fuel-burning power plants. And so they're already seeing that impact. If you look at a city like Lima, Peru, 9 million people, depending on one river, coming out of the Andes. And the population is projected to grow by 2030 to 15 million. And they do not have enough water today. And the way they deal with it is, and this is not uncommon in many parts of the world, is you only get water in one section of town 4 days a week. And then it's turned off and it goes to another section of town. But the population continues to grow. And so you see the glaciers shrinking, population growing. You can only see that this is going to become a bigger and bigger issue going forward in time. That same water that comes out is also used for irrigation for crops out in the deserts. And an expansion, government policies expanding farming in the desert, you know, turning sand dunes into cropland, doesn't make a lot of sense in the long term. Short term, there are 40,000 more jobs because those farms have been opened up. But it's a short-term gain versus long-term sustainability.
The effects of the melting ice are happening now. Lonnie tells a story about the Quelccaya Tropical Ice Cap in Peru.
A glacier has retreated up the valley. A lake has formed. The lake covers 84 acres now, 60 meters deep. Didn't exist until 1991. And there was an avalanche in March of 2006. Came off the main ice field at higher elevation above, fell into the lake, created this mini tsunami, flooded the pasture land down below, and actually the whole valley. And a number of alpaca drowned from this event. And the grasslands that are now, that the local people depended on, are no longer available for the alpaca to graze in. And so these are new hazards that the people who live in these areas are already dealing with. And they're already living right at the edge of sustainability. In many ways, they're in balance with their environment, but that environment is changing very rapidly on them due to no fault of their own. They're just having to live with the consequences of the larger changes that are being forced on the climate system.
Though the smaller, more remote communities are feeling the impact first, if we do not reverse this trend now, everyone will be dealing with lack of water and seeking adaptation strategies. Building dams is one. Similar to glaciers, dams collect water in the wet season and discharge it slowly in the dry. But the solution is not that simple, as Thompson explains.
And there's an excellent case this past year in the Salcapalca River that drains from the Quelccaya Ice Cap, which is the largest tropical ice cap on Earth in the Andes in Peru. The government decided to put in a dam to collect water. Well, there were riots. The mayor's house in Sequani was burnt down because in order to build the dam, you have to flood the lands of the Quechua Indian people who have lived in these valleys for thousands of years. And suddenly that land disappears. So, you know, when you change, even though you'll be supporting hundreds of thousands of people downstream with water and hydropower, it has a local impact on the people who live in those areas. And sometimes when you're away looking, you know, sure, we can solve this problem. This is all we have to do. But there's consequences for those changes.
Politics are not the only thing that get in the way. Culture and creed play heavily into the challenge.
those people, whether they're on the flanks of Kilimanjaro in Africa or in the Andes in Peru, anyone who can see a glacier realizes things are changing. I mean, you can see it. And in fact, we'd probably all be better off if there were a few more glaciers that people could actually observe, because it becomes real when you see those changes taking place. The belief systems that are in place around the planet are quite varied. In Bolivia, the Imura Indians believe that God lives in the glaciers on the mountaintops. And therefore, when they go from one valley to the next valley, they actually leave sacrifices to those gods, asking permission to enter that valley. And when we drilled Sahama down in Bolivia, we get all of our permits from the national government, the Park Service. But there was a village of Imura Indians at the base of this mountain. And we had to meet with the village people, and we had to have a translator. And so we talked with them for 4 hours about what we wanted to do. And there was a medicine lady who was dead set against it, that, you know, you're going to drill into this sacred place. And she was afraid that the repercussions in the weather and how it would affect their ability to survive. And at the end of the morning presentations, the head of the village, he asked me, he said, if we decide not to give you permission, will you take your people and your equipment? We have two big trucks sitting outside waiting, and go away. And I told him that, yes, we would. Because if every mountain had a village that was protecting that environment for whatever the reason, I mean, the issue was protection, then we would drill another place. And so they met for 3.5 hours discussing. Then they came out and they said, we have decided we're going to give you permission if you'll do three things. One was to donate $500 to the local library, that we would hire local people from the village to support the project, and we planned to do that. But the third was to participate in an ancient sacrifice to the gods of Sahama, asking forgiveness for what we were about to do. And I said, well, okay, what are we going to sacrifice here? Well, it turned out to be a white alpaca. And so all the people of the village and our whole drill team, there was a special place. About a week later, we all got together, and there was a ceremony where we asked permission to drill those ice fields. And since the ultimate end of an alpaca is a meal, we could do this. And I think that in many parts of the world, the native people have come to grips with living in this environment, and they explain things through their God, often as more sophisticated societies do. And I always view it as we're the outsiders coming into this world, and what we want to do is to be on the best terms possible with the local people.
The Bolivians eventually gave Thompson and crew permission to drill, after he explained he was not working for a mining company or there to destroy their homes by drilling for resources, but rather to collect ice to save these environments. And drilling for ice is a treacherous job and tests the crew's mountaineering skills on a regular basis.
Glaciers are dangerous. They're crevasses. They're avalanches. One of our biggest concerns are personnel. And the problem is, in all these things, you can reduce the risk, but you cannot eliminate the risk. Avalanches can occur anytime. We have professional mountaineers who we have put in ropes. Unlike mountaineers, we're not there to take the most difficult way to get to the site. We're looking at the easiest, safest way to get our 6 tons of equipment up to the drill site. So we do a lot of planning in this. It's high elevation, so there's health risk. The biggest problems with high elevation is pulmonary edema and the build of fluid in your lung. That can kill you in 6 hours once the process starts. or cerebral edema, which is a swelling of the brain, which can kill you in 2 hours.
And extracting these giant ice rods is no easy feat.
Depends on the country that we're working in. If you're working in Antarctica or Greenland, you have C-130 aircrafts with skis. The transport out of those areas are much easier than if you're coming out of a country where there are no logistics. So those have to be set up the year before. So if we're drilling, for example, in the Western Himalayas, we go in the year before on a preliminary project. We go in to the site. We have to test the logistics, what we need in the way of trucks to transport, what are we going to need in the way of supplies, can we get an ice core out? And so we take two shallow cores, two boxes of core, and we take it out and go through the whole shipping. Where are the problems? Because we can afford to lose that first. What you don't want to lose is the main shipment. And so once you've worked out the logistics and you think you've got all the kinks worked out, then you go back in the following year to do the main drilling. And if you're working in the Himalayas, you know, you're drilling above 20,000 feet. You're in a polar environment there. So when we drill, the cores are initially stored in pits underneath the surface of the glacier until we finish the project. And then we bring in Sherpas and porters to move the ice, backpack it, down to the edge of the glacier. When you get to the edge of the glacier, you're still 4,000 feet above where trucks can come out on the plateau. And there, in that part of the world, we use yaks to move the ice, and we use these insulated boxes. We have a cryopack material that a company makes for us. We tell them what temperature we want it to freeze at, so we can lay them out on the surface, freeze them, and then put them into the boxes. And we've run tests at the university. We know that once you seal the box, you've got 5 days to find a freezer. And so that kind of gives us a timeline. So we use the yaks to move the ice down to the trucks and make a dash across the plateau to Lhasa, where the first freezers are. Air cargo from Lhasa to Beijing, do custom clearances, to ship it to Chicago, do custom clearances, put it in a freezer truck and ship it down to Ohio State. That process usually takes a month just to get the core back. All the glaciers are retreating, and what's really remarkable is the rate at which that ice is retreating. We have now satellite images of the glaciers in Peru, and if you look at ice loss since 1988, we've lost 27-28% of the ice, and that continues. And where we have time-lapse data, the rate of ice loss is accelerating. And that means every year the glaciers are smaller. And in a way, and this is not just the Andes, it's true in the Himalayas. If you look at the last 100 years, there's actually been more water in the rivers than the rainfall would account for. And that's because they've been tapping this bank account that has built up over thousands of years in these glaciers. And so there's actually been more water.
The illusion there is more water is fleeting, and it won't be long before the legendary snow fields on Kilimanjaro in Tanzania, the highest mountain in Africa, are all dried out.
We guess that only maybe 4 or 5% of the total water is actually now coming from those glaciers. It was much more at the turn of the century when the whole mountaintop was covered with ice. But its role has diminished through the 20th century as those ice fields have retreated.
Thompson started monitoring the glacier ice melts there 11 years ago. From 1912 to 2009, 86% of the surface area of Kilimanjaro has melted. In fact, 27% of the area of ice that was on the mountain in 2000 is now gone. Furtwängler Glacier is a small remnant of an enormous ice cap, which once crowned the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro.
As we've monitored the loss of ice, on average, we have lost 4 meters of solid ice on all the ice fields from the tops down.
If current climate conditions persist, the glaciers icing the peaks of Africa's highest summit for nearly 12,000 years are predicted to disappear in a mere 8 years by 2020.
for a glacier to exist, it has to have an accumulation zone where mass is being added. And in fact, to be a glacier, the ice has to move. And it only moves because of gravity, the fact that you're adding mass to it. So these glaciers are no longer adding mass at the highest elevation. So they're just dying features, and they will disappear. There's a debate on just when they will disappear, but they will disappear.
The communities below Mount Kilimanjaro have adapted to its shrinking water supply, and for now are able to rely instead on its striking beauty for their livelihood. But that too won't last, says Thompson.
The real issue is that what impact will the loss of these ice fields have on tourism? It turns out Kilimanjaro is the number one foreign currency earner for the government of Tanzania. They have 30,000-40,000 tourists that come there every year to see the snows of Kilimanjaro. Ernest Hemingway made it famous, and people come to see the ice in the tropics. And the question is, how many people will come 20 years from now when it's just a mountain? Mm-hmm. And so the Tourist Bureau, they were very upset with our findings because and they actually said they didn't believe that this ice would disappear. But when you look at the reasons they don't believe it, is that they're trying to raise money from the World Bank to build hotels to deal with tourists coming. And, you know, that depends that you're going to have clientele that are going to continue to come. So the economic impact of the loss of the glaciers may actually be much greater than the water resource loss of those glaciers.
Thompson's career spanned 40 years studying ice, scrambling to meet glacier deadlines across the planet, and really just in time to document the history held in the Earth's melting glaciers.
If anyone had asked me at that time, would I make a living studying ice? Come on. I would have said, no way.
His unique ice archive is a widely unknown global treasure and scientific database that can never be replicated, as many of his sources have already vanished.
Lester Brown, an old tomato farmer and author and co-author of 50 books, the latest called World on the Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse, referred to by the Washington Post as one of the world's most influential thinkers, says that melting glaciers tied to water shortages will ultimately lead to a major food crisis.
We have a number of trends now, including the melting of the glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau. It is the ice melt from these glaciers that sustains the major rivers of Asia during the dry season and the irrigation systems dependent on those rivers. So we're looking at a substantially reduced supply of water to irrigate rice and wheat crops in countries like China and India. And this obviously is going to affect the world food balance. The melting of the Greenland ice sheet raises sea level and shrinks the rice harvest in Asia because a large share of Asia's rice harvest is grown in low-lying river deltas, as in Bangladesh and the Mekong Delta in Vietnam and so forth. There's a rule of thumb now among crop ecologists that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature during the growing season, we can expect a 10% decline in wheat, rice, and corn yields, for example. So these things are all tied together, and that's what we're beginning to realize. It's interesting that the earlier civilizations that declined and collapsed, in most cases, was because of a decline in the food supply. And I've long rejected the idea that that could happen to our modern civilization. But unless we can turn some of these trends around, unless we can stabilize climate, unless we can stabilize aquifers, we're going to be in trouble on the food front.
SQ Radio interviewed Lester Brown and Coco Warner, the head of the Climate Adaptation Section for the United Nations. Both featured in the 2010 documentary film Climate Refugees about the impact of climate change on societies. Warner says no matter what, every citizen needs to prioritize climate change.
I think there have been a lot of questions in the United States about whether or not climate change is real. And I'm from the U.S. I'm actually a hometown Utah girl, but I live in Germany. And I'm always quite amazed that there's a debate about climate change. The science is quite clear. However, I do respect the questions that are being raised in certain pockets, and it's very important that we always ask better questions, and I think that's what scientists are trying to do. Is climate change real? What are the impacts? What's causing it? Everyone needs to ask those questions, and scientists keep each other honest. There's not a lot of money in science, at least respective to business or other things, and all that scientists have are their good reputation. What I wanted to say is I think the questions that perhaps come from the far right about whether or not climate change is real, very valid, and they're respectable questions. However, I do have a concern about the motivations for the questioning and the motivations for casting doubt, one, that climate change is real, two, that people's actions have anything to do with it, and three, that we already impact, or we already feel the impacts of climate change. Because at the end of the day, it's about responsibility. I hope that there is no climate change. I really hope so. But I've been out there. We did case studies all over the world. And in every single case study, migrants told us that environmental change and climate change contribute right now to their ability to survive and to their choices to move. And in some cases, people don't have choices. It's impacting us now. And I think if we look away and don't acknowledge responsibility or acknowledge our own power to act, we'll miss tremendous opportunities that will affect us. Climate change isn't happening in some faraway place. It's happening here, and it's about giving chances to our children. And left, right, center, we all want our children to have good lives. And if we don't act now, we will rob future generations of that possibility.
Lester Brown recently wrote a note in a copy of his new book to Lonnie Thompson that read, "Things do not seem to be headed in the right direction." Lonnie told us that, unfortunately, that just about sums up the general feeling in the scientific community.
The melting glaciers don't only wash away history, but initiate a cascade of environmental repercussions, like rising sea levels, floods, and subsequent food and water shortage. And though communities with fewer resources and lower incomes are being hit first, this is a global problem. Nature is the timekeeper, and at the current melting rate, no one knows exactly how long we have before the world's glaciers completely disappear. Abrupt climate change strategies to reduce greenhouse gases and emissions from fossil fuels need to be adopted, and we all need to act now. For SQ Radio, this is Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.